The mail arrived at my house several days ago. I scanned the stack looking for something interesting, which doesn't very often come. And when I suddenly scanned a return address in the upper left-hand corner of an envelope that imparted a tremulousness to my hands as I flipped open the flap and fumbled to rip it open. The return address read, Department of Treasury, Internal Revenue Service, 1973 Rulon White Boulevard, Ogden, Utah. The thoughtful IRS agent thought enough of me to do me the service of sitting down and writing a form letter to me. Why does it make me worry when I get a letter from the IRS? Why does it leave a cold sweat beading on the furrowed brow above my worried expression?
Going to be audited?
Well, that's, and why would an audit worry me? It's not an audit in this case.
You made a mistake.
You made a mistake. And why would a mistake bother me that much from the IRS? That's right, an expensive mistake, because after all is said and done, I'm worried that it's going to say, you owe, pay up. That is what I was worried about in this case. I'm not afraid to tell you. The IRS had sent me a previous notice that they had reviewed my 2012 returns, and they did the calculations, and they figured that I owed, I don't remember what the amount was, but it was enough to know that that check would have hurt a lot to write. But I don't understand the tax code, so I gave the letter to my tax preparer and said, please help, which he did. And this is the follow-up letter, and you'll see that it says, we've reviewed your answer to our question, and the amount due is zero, which I was very happy to get this letter to know that the matter was settled. But in our last lesson, which was 2 weeks ago, in Mark chapter 12, verses 13 through 17, Jesus wrote us a letter, and it should have immediately received our attention, because his message was similar to the one I was worried about from the IRS, and it was, you owe, pay up. And Herodians and Pharisees had tried to trap Jesus with a question concerning a political issue, whether or not to pay the poll tax to Caesar. They asked, shall we pay or shall we not? And after calling for a coin and calling attention to the image that was impressed upon the coin, Jesus answered their political hot-button question with the answer, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Familiar answer. Familiar from our knowledge of the passage. Jesus' point was the image impressed upon a thing helps to identify an obligation due, and the one to whom it should be rendered. In the case of coins and poll taxes, Caesar's image impressed upon the coin reminds us of our obligation to pay taxes to the civil authorities, while God's image impressed on each one of us reminds us that we ought to render to Him our lives and our love and our honor and our obedience. The main point of Jesus' answer to the question was the obligation that we have to God to render our lives to Him. We are image bearers and we owe Him our lives. And in fact, Jesus will develop that theme or that lesson later in the chapter, Mark 12:28, when he said in response to another scribe who asked a question about the greatest commandment, Jesus answered in verse 30, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength." Each of us has the obligation to render to God the things that are God, our mind, soul, strength, and love. And we'll get to that in due time, but I thought that Jesus' answer otherwise, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, would give us an opportunity to just pause and consider in a little more detail what the things are that are Caesar's that ought to be rendered to him. That is, what is the Christian's obligation and duty to the state? Jesus says, pay up. You owe. And you owe taxes. Is there anything else? Well, let's look at a couple of passages anyway, while we're on the subject, just look at it a little further. And the first passage we'll look at is Romans chapter 13. Pastor, I expect we'll get to Romans 13 in the next 2 or 3 years, maybe. She's on chapter 7 today, so 13 is just right around the corner. But just as a preview, maybe, to what we may learn in more detail, we'll just look at verses 1 through 7 of Romans 13. First two verses read as follows. Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation on themselves. What ought we to render to Caesar according to Paul here? What duty is identified in verse 1? Right, and what is your duty to the civil authorities, Ron? Right, be in subjection is the way mine puts it. That is the duty identified. Anyone want to offer just a general definition of what it might mean to be in subjection? Obey, that's right. It would involve an abiding obedience.
Submission.
All right, good. Which is subjection. Maybe a loyalty as well, a loyal law keeping. Those are ideas that are involved in subjection. And verse 1 provides a reason why we ought to be in subjection. What does verse 1 explain as a reason why? That's right, because God ordains the authorities, for no authority exists, none except by God's appointment. Be in subjection to them, because God has put them where they are. None exist except those that are established by God. He says, be in subjection to the magistrate because his office of authority exists and has been established by God. Verse 2 describes the implication that applies to those who resist and oppose the duty to be in subjection. He says, therefore what? By way of warning to those who resist the duty to be in subjection. Yeah, the advantage for you in this larger room is the seats are a bit more comfortable. The disadvantage to me is when you give lucid and scholarly answers, which you typically do, I hear a which I'm sure means something to you, but not me. So I saw Don's lips move. So Don, what did you say when you
received condemnation?
Okay, why? This is the further.
You're opposing God.
All right, good. They oppose God to resist authority is to oppose God, which is something you ought never to do, and they will accordingly receive condemnation. These are compelling reasons to do your duty, to be in subjection. All exist by God's establishment, and those who resist and oppose the duty are opposing God and inviting the threat of judgment. Verses 3 and 4 provide an additional reason to be in subjection by explaining the role that God has designed for civil authorities. This is what they say: "For rulers are not a cause for fear, for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil." What role does the civil magistrate serve for the ordering and ruling of the state, according to these verses? What kinds of things has God put them in their place to do? Punishment and praise. Good, that alliterates nicely. Their role is to punish the evildoers and to praise the good. To spank the one and to support the other. All right, if we want to keep alliterating, that's right. Verse 3, they're a cause for fear for evildoers. Verse 3, they praise those with good behavior. Verse 4, they're a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. They punish evildoers, or that is their appropriate role, and they praise the good. And God has put them in their place to have that ordering influence on a society. It's a blessing of God that He appoints rulers for that purpose. And a lawless land is no great blessing. It's not a free place when there is no ruler over the bunch by and large. And so he summarizes the point in verse 5. "Wherefore, it is necessary to be in subjection not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake." Be in subjection not only to avoid punishment, but also because it's the right thing to do. And then the specific renderings of what we render to Caesar are mapped out a little further in verses 6 and 7. Let me read those. It says, "For because of this you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." What ought we to render as we are in subjection?
Their due.
Their due. And what is their due? Right. Taxes, custom to whom custom, fear to fear, honor to whom honor. What does it mean to give honor to someone? Well, you're probably mumbling. It means to recognize that they have a certain rank and title that entitles them to our respect and esteem, whether we agree with them or like them or not. So Paul, here in this, what I'm assuming is a familiar passage to you, commands us to be in subjection to civil authorities, to be willing to render to the magistrate his due taxes, and his revenues, and his respect. It's to be loyal followers rather than disloyal rebels and tax evaders. Our government in the U.S. allows for, I don't know whether it's a doctrine anywhere, but we'll just put it in parentheses, loyal opposition. This is not true of all governments, but ours allows for those who are in the state and in subjection to oppose in principle, the principles advanced by the government. It's allowed. Loyal followers of the authorities in place are allowed to advance opposing points of view without threat of recrimination. Those are kind of the principles on which our government is based. But it's your duty to be in subjection to the civil authorities with fear and honor, to be willing to render your leaders their due, to be loyal followers. And when you subscribe to different policies and points of view than your civil authorities, let me urge you, loyal opposers, to avoid bad examples that are everywhere on cable TV and the radio. Would you like to summarize, perhaps, the attitude that you might hear or see on cable TV or talk radio? This guy's an idiot. Okay, Danny wasn't summarizing, he was just giving an example, all right? What do you call it when someone has a show based on saying, this guy's an idiot, and that guy's an idiot, and that guy's an idiot? Okay, that's right. That's what we call whiny complaining, all right? All right, now throats start to clear when I put this on the board. All right, good, I'm glad. All right, I'm telling you that your duty is to be in subjection to the civil authorities. And even though in America, this is America, we're Americans, we can be loyal opposition, okay, fine. But you ought not to ignore your clear duty. And I'm suggesting that you ought to beware of adopting bad examples in your culture of whiny complaining, which are rampant. Don't wear scowls of contempt and resort to dishonorable name-calling of governing authorities. You are free to advance your point of view. You are free to advance an opposing point of view clearly, forcefully, and respectfully, but leave no doubt about your loyalty. You ought to be a loyal lawkeeper. Not a whiny complainer. Come on. I mean, it's possible to advance an opposing point of view without adopting the snarkiness that is so popular and that improves ratings on shows. Render loyal subjection, pay your taxes, maintain an attitude of honor and fear. Someone might object. Well, how can you tell us to be in subjection and to honor such a bunch of unvarnished bums? Now, I just can't see it. How am I supposed to be in subjection to them?
It's not subjection to God.
All right, it is subjection to them as subjection to God, isn't it? Be in subjection to the ones that God has placed over you, because those who resist are opposing God and are a threat of condemnation. Reread Romans 13. I hope it's not just me telling you this, but Paul, and just an observation I would offer you for your consideration. I'm often amazed at how some men are able to speak at length from 1 Peter 3 and Ephesians 5:22 with footnotes added about how sweet their wives' submission ought to be to them, and how name-calling and whiny complaining would never be a part of biblical submission of wives to husbands. And the same person can then go on to be a whiny complainer about the civil authorities over them. The duty in both cases is to be in subjection, wives to husbands and citizens to the state. But on the one hand, he can expect sweet submission from his wife, and on the other hand, he displays a sour snarkiness towards the ones to whom he's supposed to be in subjection to. Just an observation. I think the character of the submission should be similar in both cases. But I digress. Now, the Christian's duty is to be in subjection to civil authorities. The duty is to be a loyal law abider. But it does not require us to obey any and all commands that the state might make. Can you think of some Bible examples when we ought not, when a Bible example is of those who refuse to be in subjection to the state and who were right? In other words, okay, I'm just going to restate the point and then I'll get to your answer, and I appreciate that. Paul has said it is our duty to be in subjection, and it is, because God has placed them. What I'm saying now is it's not an absolute duty. There are exceptions to the rule. Melissa, can you think of a...
Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego,
which was in the McShane reading yesterday, I think. What happened in the case of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego?
Daniel refused to obey to...
What did the state require them to do?
Obey the king.
Obey King Nebuchadnezzar. And what did Nebuchadnezzar build?
A statue.
A big golden statue. And what did Nebuchadnezzar require of the state, of all the citizens? That they bow down and worship, that they practice idolatry. And so, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel heard the state that required this. They knew their duty to be in subjection to the civil authorities, and so they refused. Why? Why was it proper for them to disobey or disregard a duty that ordinarily applied?
Against God's commandments.
That's right. You didn't hear Melissa say it, but because the state required them to disobey God. God commands no idolatry. The state said you must practice idolatry. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego rightly refused. When the state requires you to disobey God, then it is your duty to disobey the civil authorities. Otherwise, generally speaking, though, your duty is to be in subjection. Can you think of another Bible example? Pete?
Acts 22:25. Is it lawful for you to flog a man with a Roman citizen and uncondemned? Paul asked those guys about to get them.
All right. Well, I think that would... Paul was appealing to the law for rescue there, and he won, so he used the law to his advantage. That's good. Don?
Acts chapter 4, 18 and 19. When they summoned them, they commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. Peter and John said,
That's right. The state required them to stop preaching the gospel, and they refused. And they said in Acts chapter 5, 28, 29, on the same subject, we must obey God rather than men. So, by and large, as a general rule, as Paul has described, it is our duty to be in subjection, except when the civil authorities require you to disobey God. The other mistake that Christians in our age are especially inclined to stumble into is trusting too much in princes and civil authorities. And Psalm 146:3 warns us, "Do not trust in princes and mortal men in whom there is no salvation." It is lawful, it's appropriate for Christians to be involved in the political process, to vote responsibly, to advance specific causes, to vote for certain candidates. You ought to, and it's fine, and you ought to be informed and involved, and it's a good thing, and I encourage it. But beware, as you do so, of trusting too much in princes to do things that they cannot do. Beware of pinning your hopes on a prince to do that which they cannot, like abolishing original sin. That requires the gospel, and you should require on the gospel to do that. How about another passage? I didn't hear you say it, but I assume you were saying that's a good idea. How about 1 Timothy 2? 1 Timothy chapter 2. We are digressing to... We are digressing a little to consider what it means to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. That's why we're doing this, if you forgot how we got on this subject today. 1 Peter 2, 1 through 6. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, in order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. For there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself as a ransom for all, the testimony born at the proper time. According to verse 1 and 2, what ought we to render to God on behalf of Caesar? Supplications. And?
Prayer.
And entreaties. Okay, and all of these I would put under the end, thanksgiving. And I would maybe put all of those into the category of prayer. We ought to render to God prayer on behalf of the magistrate as rendering to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And you will notice that the duty to pray extends not only to kings and those who are in authority, but for all men. And this, by the way, this passage, by the way, is one of the reasons why frequently during his pastoral prayer, you will hear pastor praying for, not kings, but for presidents and others who have the rule over us. He does so because Paul instructs us to. Not just that he happens to be a very patriotic pastor who likes to bring up things like that, but he understands that we owe it to Caesar to pray to God, to make entreaties, to offer thanksgiving on his behalf. And Paul supplies reasons for such praying, for kings and for all. Why? According to verse 2. Reasons why we ought to pray for kings and all men. And there's more than one. Martin?
So we can live a tranquil and quiet life?
A tranquil and quiet life. Now, as Americans, you may be unfamiliar with this concept, because why do Americans, what do Americans want out of life? They want to have it all, right? Don't you guys listen to cable TV? Come on. I mean, Americans want to have it all. They want a life of excitement and indulgence and, all right, well, maybe not. All right. Tranquil, quiet life and godliness and dignity is the life that the Scriptures commend. Maybe we ought to reconsider it in light of the trends of our own secular culture, domestic tranquility and godly Christians. That's a very desirable outcome and is one of the potential outcomes of praying for leaders, for kings, and for all men. What reasons are added in verse 3 through 6? What other reasons are indicated? Ron? That's right. Well, I just want to do God's will in my life. Well, fine, start praying for kings and for all men. All right? Because you know that that's acceptable to God. Any other reasons identified or implied or suggested? That's right. And that's described as very desirable to God, because the salvation of sinners is something that God desires. Oh, there's no E in desirable except on the end. All right. Good. Praying for kings and for all men may result in their salvation, and salvation is desirable to God. Point of fact, he sent a mediator, one mediator between God and men, that mediator giving himself as a ransom. Pay what you owe to Caesar by praying for him and for all men, that we may lead tranquil and godly lives, or tranquil and quiet lives in godliness and dignity. Pray for the country he rules, for his salvation and the salvation of many. One more passage. 1 Peter 2. First Peter 2, 13 through 17. It says there, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. Peter sounds a lot like Paul in this regard, doesn't he? For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Well, again, what ought we to render to Caesar? Submission, just as Paul said. And notice what submitting includes, or suggests, or implies, according to verse 15. Those who are submitting to the authorities, it's expected that they'll be doing what, according to verse 15? Doing the will of God, right? And doing right. Behaving well. Those who submit to Caesar generally ought to reflect good behavior. And what are the fringe benefits of doing right and behaving well, according to verse 15? You silence fools. That's right. You silence ignorant fools. You don't always, but your chances for silencing ignorant fools are improved considerably, according to the Scriptures, by doing right rather than by other means. So, enjoy the fringe benefits, or expect the fringe benefits of doing right. And what else do we owe Caesar, according to verse 17? Honor. And we understood that from Paul as well. Submit to civil authorities, doing right. It's God's will, and it will silence, perhaps, ignorant fools. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Live in subjection to your leaders, willing to be a loyal law abider, behaving well, doing right, paying taxes, giving honor. Pray for your leaders that we will live quiet and tranquil lives in godliness and dignity, and that the one mediator between God and man might grant salvation to many. That was our sidebar on rendering to Caesar. Your thoughts? All right, Don?
When or should we ever call a spade a spade? In other words, if we've got an evil man, say, King Moonbeam, and he determines to abort every certain child who begins with the letter B or what have you, and it doesn't affect us directly as a Christian, because we're not the ones actually doing it. However, this is being done kind of under our watch.
Okay, so Don's question is, when does a Christian call a spade a spade? When does a Christian speak up against evil things advocated by or allowed by the civil magistrate? All right, Wayne?
I think we have a couple examples that we can look off of. You can take one of two sides, that you can take the route of John the Baptist. You say, hey, what you're doing is wrong. It's not lawful for you to have. But with John the Baptist, we see what punishment he receives. And so we do that in a manner, and we can say, hey, your ruler, your king, are doing something that is against God. When we do so, we should be able to readily accept the punishments that come along with that, knowing what laws are in place. Or we can take the opposite road. We can look at Romans 13, and the Caesar that was over them at that time often did horrendous things to Christians, yet we have Paul saying to be submissive to them. If we do that, we know that we probably avoid some of that confrontation, but yet we're still committed to pray and intercede for them. I think that at any time that we have those rulers that are over us, we can, with biblical precedence, say, hey, don't do that, but we are also to expect the other side of that biblical precedence and to receive the due punishment if we go against those laws and those rulers. So I think we can kind of take two roads on that, depending on how, if we want to face the wrath or if we want to intercede and pray for them, what should we want to do?
Okay. And they're not necessarily two opposite roads. John the Baptist wasn't necessarily violating Romans 13 when he spoke up against Herod. So it's not do the one or the other, but sometimes one is called for, sometimes the other. And your answer is a good one. It requires wisdom, but the general duties are laid out for us to be in subjection, to be a loyal law abider. We are allowed to express opposing viewpoints. In our land, anyway, we don't have to fear immediate retribution, and it's not against the law to express an opposing view to those who are in authority. But I guess do so, looking to God for wisdom, to do so in as submissive a way as you can. I don't advocate civil disobedience because I don't think the scriptures do, except in the Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego category, in which case it's your duty to disobey when the state requires you to disobey God. Even though the state allows for many evils that we condemn, the state doesn't require us to do those evils. Your thoughts, Pastor?
Well, that's the same as, you were comparing earlier the relationship of a husband and wife, the nature of that submission. Wife to her husband does not require, or does not expect, that she will not address, for example, the sins of her husband. And then, so to do so, to be faithful in that, again, it's not breaking ranks at all. Seeking to do the good. So it is appropriate, even in terms of our submission, we're not breaking ranks, but we are doing it again in terms of God who made us do it. So, we bring forth His truth and declare these things, and that's, again, it's not an either-or, it's not unsubmissive to direct clearly, and in a certain sense, prophetically, what God has to say about the situation.
Good, and I guess I'd repeat my warning against falling into the trap or stumbling into the common mistake. Well, I can't voice my opposition to any effect by submitting, so I'm going to join ranks with the whiny complainers and adopt the bad models that we see in our culture. And I think it's foolish to become a whiny complainer rather than a wise, articulate opposer with a submissive attitude generally. Charles?
You raised the spousal parallel. And what's a humbling aspect of that, as well as our country's election of leadership, is the realization that you picked.
Right, and that you can try and pick another one next time, would be if you oppose. John, your thoughts?
None.
None in this case, or at least none that he wants to express at this time. Martin?
When you talk about authority, it reminded me of the centurion. And Christ said that the example of authority that he used was the greatest display of faith that he had ever seen. And he said, Lord, I'm not worthy that you come under my roof, but just speak the word only, and my servant will be healed, for I also am a man under authority, whose soldier is under me. I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, do this. And then that was Christ's response. So his faith was, the example of Christ submitting to the authority of the Father, and the Father giving him authority on earth, and the centurion likened that to himself having authority over and under him.
It's good. Good. Well, it's not, we don't have time to introduce a new topic. I thought I didn't ask Charles to make a statement, but Charles would easily have a 7-minute talk to give. Since you just arrived back a week ago, we've had some emails from you, but maybe you could just tell us what you're up to, tell us what we can pray for in the final 7 minutes, rather than me opening up a passage and everyone thinking, oh no, he's not going to open up a passage at the end of the lesson, there's no time to do this. Rather than discouraging the class, I will give you 5 to 7 minutes to encourage the class on whatever you want us to know about you. And I know that you have, even though I've caught you a little off guard, you won't mind because you have many things to tell us. So if you don't mind.
Well, first of all, let me say it's a real joy for our family to be back at Faith Community Church. And really, we don't expect to be here too long this pass, only a couple of weeks. So because of that, we're hoping to come back, expecting to come back in January and be here longer. Haven't worked out those plans yet. For people who may be visiting, but I bet everybody who's visiting still, unless this is your first Sunday, you probably heard about us, and we are a missionary family, been associated with Faith Community Church at least since 1993, which was my first time to come back here and visit you, 3 years after we went to the field of Mozambique, Africa. And let me just say real quickly again to catch people up to speed who are visiting, we've been involved there since 1990 in a medical evangelistic ministry and also a church planting ministry and also a ministry to try to help the churches that already exist in the surrounding areas to get some doctrine under their feet. And so we have literature distribution ministries going on and seminars and training conferences for other pastors. And lately, we've been very happy to see these roles being taken over by Mozambican brethren who have been with us, some of them for 20 years now, and we're seeing second generation Christians being raised up now, walking in the truth. And when there is an opportunity, I'll share in some detail with pictures about that one of these days. The reason we're here in the States right now, actually, we sort of were caught unprepared to come home for furlough. We didn't plan to come home for furlough, really, is because our oldest son, Kent, has gotten married. He married in July 26th, to a wonderful young woman that he met at Covenant College. And so we had to be here for that wedding and paying money to come bring the whole family over to the States. We thought we'd try to take advantage of the time that we're here to kill a few other birds with the same stone. And so we've been visiting family and visiting supporting churches, and of course Faith Community Church is our home church, and so we're back here now. And I guess the main thing, if I were to summarize, not to steal any thunder from some future opportunity perhaps to talk about the ministry in Mozambique, we've been there only 2.5 years since our last furlough. And I went back 2.5 years ago to Mozambique expecting to turn right around and come back to the States, because we have a large hospital. It's a beautiful building. It's cost about close to $1 million to build, and we've got to get some surgeons to go to work there so we can open the doors and begin functioning. So recruiting is the big push that we need to be focusing on right now, recruiting medical personnel for this hospital. And so while we're here in the States, we're hoping we can possibly try to do that as well. Forgotten where I was going to go with that, but you could please pray for us that the Lord would help us to set up appointments to visit other churches, to make the ministry known in places where it's not already known, and get referrals to people who have a doctrines of grace viewpoint on salvation, because we want this hospital to function primarily. It's primarily a hospital, of course, but the most important thing to us is to take advantage of the opportunities this provides to acquaint people with Jesus Christ. And the spiritual ministry is far and away the most important thing. Because that's important to us, it's important that the people hear a gospel message that will provide a good foundation for them for the rest of their Christian life. What we see in Mozambique, it's a country with 23 million people, 20% of whom say that they are evangelical Christians. And yet, when new tribes came into Mozambique just a few years ago, and they did a survey passing through the northern part of the country during a period of 3 weeks, interviewing all the evangelical pastors and elders that they came across, they asked them a series of questions. One of the questions was, is there a problem between God and men? And all the evangelical leaders knew that there was a problem. And they asked, what's the problem? And they all knew that the problem was sin. And they asked, has the Lord provided a means for dealing with that problem? And they all knew that He had done that also. But then when they asked, what is the solution? Only three people, of all the people they surveyed during 3 weeks, and these were only leaders in the evangelical church, even mentioned the name of Jesus Christ in their answer. The responses were, He's given us the Ten Commandments, we need to obey the Ten Commandments, or we need to go to church, or we need to follow the Bible, or we need to help other people, etc. So clearly an orientation toward works salvation. Only three pastors mentioned Jesus Christ, and two of them mentioned Him only in the context of we need to follow His example and be like Jesus Christ. There was only one pastor who mentioned a presentation of the substitutionary atonement of Jesus Christ dying on the cross for our sins, for the sins of all those who believe in Him. And they were impressed with that answer, and they asked him, well, where do you learn these things? And he said, well, of course, I have my Bible. And then I have these books that help me understand the Bible. And he took them into his hut, and he showed him a nice shelf. And on the shelf he had a lot of excellent quality literature. And they asked him, where did you get these books in Mozambique? And he said, it's from going to our conferences that we've been holding for 15 years in the city of Nampula. People come from all of Mozambique's 10 provinces to our annual conference, and they have a chance to buy books there. Well, the problem in the church in Mozambique is that they don't have doctrine. They don't have doctrine because they start off on the wrong foot with a whole view of salvation, a gospel message that doesn't really save people. So at the hospital, we're very much concerned about evangelism. The spiritual has the priority, even though that's not all that we're doing. Obviously, we would be spending most of the time in medical care. But if we're concerned about evangelism, then we have to be concerned about the gospel. And if we're concerned about the gospel that's being taught by these men, then they need to be people with the good doctrines of grace foundation as they present the gospel to people. So we're only fishing in, if I can use the term, reformed ponds, or people, churches that appreciate the doctrines of grace. So we're here to recruit, hopefully, but we're recruiting in a small pond, looking for physicians who are going to be reformed in their soteriology. So anyway, that's what we're here for right now, and appreciate this opportunity. And somewhere down the road, I know I'll be available to talk a lot more about Mozambique, but that's what we're doing here right now. The real reason was because of my son getting married, so we were caught unprepared, not geared up to visit a lot of churches on furlough, but that's what we need to do. Thank you very much.